Okay, I guess we can get started here. I'm Tony Hunter from the Salk Institute, and it's a pleasure to be here. I have already learned a great deal about pancreatic cancer, and I'm sure I will learn a great deal more in the next 2 days. As must be apparent to all of you, I do not work on pancreatic cancer. I think the closest I've ever come was to have some Mia Packer cells growing in the lab once. So given that, it's something of a challenge to say something relevant or about pancreatic cancer. And so I'm going to do what I always do under these conditions. That's talk about kinases, because kinases are near and dear to my heart. And with luck, what we understand about the role of kinases in cancer will actually be relevant to pancreatic cancer. So I'll give a very general introduction about protein kinases, their role in cancer, and the success of efforts to target protein kinases in different types of cancer. And then if there's time, I'll end up with a brief story about a project ongoing in the lab that could be relevant to pancreatic cancer. So, as most of you will know, there are a large number of protein kinase genes in the human genome, and through the efforts largely of Gerard Manning, who's now at the Salk Institute, a catalog of all protein kinases was developed following the completion of the genome sequencing, and we came up with 518 distinct protein kinase genes. That number may be a little soft, and there may be a couple of new ones that have been found since 2002, but it's over 500 protein kinases, of which probably 90% are active protein kinases. The others appear to be lacking catalytic activity and have other functions. Not surprisingly, given that there are a large number of protein kinases, protein phosphorylation is a major intracellular activity, a major cellular regulatory process, and we're beginning to learn how complex this is now through phosphoproteomic analysis being carried out through mass spec methods. And here are just a few examples of phosphoproteomic analyses carried out by Steve Gigi's lab and by Matthias Mann's lab. Now, for instance, you can see here that in HeLa cells, you know, cervical carcinoma line, the Mann lab identified 6,600 different phosphorylation sites in just over 2,200 proteins, presumably intracellular proteins. And about 15% of these phosphorylations change more than twofold within 20 minutes of adding EGF. So it's clearly a very dynamic process. It's going to be very complex, and every cell type, every cancer type, will have a different phosphoproteome, and there will be different protein kinases and phosphatases obviously involved in maintaining that network. Currently, the cell signaling phosphocyte database has nearly 60,000 distinct phosphorylation sites, and the number is growing almost exponentially, I would say. So I think what this tells us is that the majority of intracellular proteins, there are a few secreted phosphoproteins, like casein, for instance, but the majority of intracellular proteins are targets for phosphorylation, and probably at multiple sites in many cases, and that under appropriate conditions, the level of phosphorylation will change, and that will affect the activity of the protein. Again, not surprisingly, given the importance of protein kinases in cellular function and organismic function, perturbation in kinase-based signaling systems then plays a role in disease, and in particular in cancer. And this is a compilation, it's already out of date, that Gerard Manning made of protein kinase genes involved in different diseases. And you can see by far the majority of kinases are implicated in cancer. I think the current estimates are that about a third of all of the human protein kinases are involved in disease, and at least 125 have been implicated in cancer, either through mutation, both gain of function and loss of function mutation, or through overexpression or underexpression. And kinases being enzymes, and I'll come back to this in a second, are tractable drug targets in the sense that you have an activity that you can measure and inhibit. And so they have become one of the favored targets for at least cancer drug development, but also other diseases like immunity and inflammation. So this is just a little more information about the kinases involved in cancer. At least 120, is probably 125 now, protein kinases have been implicated in cancer through a variety of methods. Several of these were implicated because they were captured by oncogenic viruses, and mutant forms of these kinases, like SARC being the prototypic example, cause cancer in model systems. More recently, array analysis has also shown changes in the expression of protein kinases, both up and down. And particularly important has been cancer genome sequencing or resequencing efforts of tumor genes, focusing on the kinome, as we call this collection of protein kinase genes, by several different major groups, including the Sanger Center, the Hopkins Group, etc. And there have been some striking successes here. For instance, the Sanger Group discovered that BRAF is mutated in 60 to 70% of melanomas, quite unsuspected at the time. And there's been, particularly from the Hopkins Group, evidence that PI3 kinase pathway genes, including several protein kinases and phosphatases, are commonly mutated in colon cancer as well as other types of cancer. And there are a number of kinome-wide sequencing efforts in different cancers that have been published and more are underway. And I'll come back to the relevance of this to pancreatic cancer in a minute. So I think this will be an ongoing effort. There will be additional protein kinases identified that are mutated in specific types of cancer or subtypes of cancer. One issue that has emerged is the question of whether a mutation that one observes in a cancer is a driver mutation. Is it in fact important for that cancer, phenotype of that cancer, or is it simply a passenger mutation? And as we all know, cancer genomes are commonly unstable depending on the nature of the cancer. And so many genes acquire mutations. That does not mean to say that they're actually important for the cancer, and that's something that one has to then try and determine or validate when one sees that a protein kinase is mutated. One has to try and then resolve whether that mutation affects the activity of the protein kinase and in what way, up or down, and whether it then might play a role in a specific cancer type. Some kinases have been implicated because they are familial and they can predispose to cancer, and those I think are well validated cancer targets. And I think in the future, the phosphoproteomic analysis will be a way of defining potential kinase targets, particularly in cases where there's no obvious mutation in the kinase, but the pathway in which the kinase is involved is upregulated and potentially playing a role in a cancer, then that may be defined through phosphoproteomic signatures, and I think is potentially one way then to find kinase targets for drug development. Another approach that has been and it will continue to be useful in our genetic functional genetic analysis in the mouse and other model organisms, where one can mutate kinase genes, either knockouts or knock-in mutations, as well as screens in tumor cell lines using SH or siRNA kinome-wide screens to knock down or knock out specific kinase targets and look at the effect on phenotypes. And this can also be done as synthetic lethals, where one combines siRNAs or siRNAs, shRNAs with small molecule screens. And there have already been a number of kinome-wide RNAi screens looking for phenotypic changes in different organisms and different systems. I won't really take you through this. There's been effective use of RNAi screens in Drosophila tissue culture cells that have been pioneered by Paramount Group and the Glover Group here. In terms of cancer relevance, there was a screen by the Blennis Group looking for protein kinases and phosphatases in this case that affected survival in of HeLa cells in response to Saurosporin, I think it was. And they identified a significant number of protein kinases that enhanced apoptotic responses. And there is another fairly recent screen in pancreatic cancer cells, Miopaca cells, in fact, by the De Gorne group, looking for increased spontaneous apoptosis or apoptosis enhanced by gemcitabine. And again, they found a significant number. I think this one of these is wrong. This must be 73, I think. Protein kinases that show up in this screen. Now, the issue obviously will be to try and establish whether these protein kinases really are playing a significant role in survival of Miopaca cells, other pancreatic cell lines, and obviously ultimately in pancreatic cancer itself. One issue is obviously that these screens have a very high hit rate, and validation then is going to be the key. And then ultimately, once validated, defining what the functions of these kinases are in, say, apoptosis or any other phenotype that one wants to assay, like morphological changes, invasiveness, metastasis. And this is just an example from the Blennis group study showing a series of kinases that were able to increase apoptosis in HeLa cells, CDK6, that's near and dear to Mariano's heart, etc. The Sanger group, headed by Mike Stratton, actually maintains a census of cancer genes, which they define as genes that are implicated by mutation in cancer. So this is not up and down regulation. This is consistent mutations in human cancer. And of their 355 cancer genes, 30 are protein kinases. So about 10% of all cancer genes, as defined by this criterion, are protein kinase genes. And just here are a few examples of protein kinases that we know to be involved in human cancer. BCR-ABL, the fusion gene and protein that's expressed in chronic myelogenous leukemia, is a prime example, clearly a driver mutation. But there are also amplification of some kinases like EGF receptor and B2 in breast cancer. You should note, however, that not all tyrosine kinase genes are implicated in proliferative aspects or growth aspects. There are tyrosine kinases that have been shown in certain situations to be tumor suppressor genes. For instance, CFES in colon carcinoma, where there are mutations the Hopkins group identified, and they thought initially these would be activating mutations. They turned out to be inactivating mutations. And so this is something of an issue in terms of developing tyrosine kinase inhibitors for cancer therapy. You don't want to hit, obviously, tyrosine kinases that are acting as tumor suppressor proteins. There are also many serine kinases implicated in cancer. BRAF, I've already mentioned. But there are also a number of serine kinases that act as tumor suppressors. Again, then it can be an issue of kinase inhibitor specificity in terms of therapy. And although I won't say any more about it, protein phosphatases and lipid phosphatases have been implicated through mutation in cancer, and obviously PTEN we've heard about already. So I don't really want to go through this other than to reiterate that protein kinases being enzymes make good targets. There were concerns initially when this idea was first mooted that it might be difficult to make specific inhibitors of protein kinases because the catalytic cleft, the catalytic site of the majority of protein kinases is highly conserved, both sequence-wise and structure-wise, and they all have to bind ATP, and so the concern was that it would be hard to make a specific inhibitor because of that conservation and also because of the high intracellular concentrations of ATP with which the inhibitor would have to compete. But in fact, it has been possible, as you will know, and we have several approved kinase inhibitors that are relatively selective. I would say none of these is really totally selective. In fact, Gleevec clearly has several targets, and that may even be important for why it works so well in CML. So as of now, there are six tyrosine kinase inhibitors that have been approved for therapy by the FDA in different types of cancer. Gleevec was the first in 2001, targets BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase, as well as KIT and PDGF receptor. Iressa and Tarceva are EGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Ticerb, just been approved, is an ERBB2 EGFR dual inhibitor. Sutent is a very broad specificity inhibitor that inhibits KIT amongst other receptor tyrosine kinases. And Sprycel, which is actually a mixed SARC-ABL inhibitor. So there are many other protein kinase inhibitors in clinical trials, at least 70, according to one recent count. And several of these are targeted against serine kinases, like Aurora, and the RAF inhibitor, sorafenib, has recently been approved for treatment of renal carcinoma. And then in addition, there is rapamycin and its analogs, Rapalox, which is an inhibitor of one of the two mTOR complexes, and I suspect that Neil will talk about that. So I think in the future we can look forward to an increasing number of protein kinase inhibitor drugs that will be approved for treatment of cancer and probably other human diseases, both singly and in combination, and there may well be protein phosphatase drugs as well. The key, I think, will be molecular, genetic, and proteomic diagnosis to identify which combinations to give and which patients are going to respond. So, for instance, you know, Tarceva is most effective in lung cancer patients with specific EGFR mutations. And then another issue that is becoming increasingly important is that due to the genetic malleability of the cancer cell genome, inhibitor resistance mutations arise frequently due to mutations often in the kinase itself. And this is going to necessitate, and already has, the development of second and third generation inhibitors, which is one reason why dasatinib was developed to work on Gleevec-resistant CML. And I think combinatorial use of protein kinase inhibitors and other signal transduction inhibitors obviously will continue or will be the way to go in the future. So given that, what are the therapeutic challenges? How can one define the right combination of rationally targeted drugs for a specific cancer? Which pathways does one want to hit and in what combination? And how can they also be used most effectively in combination with existing chemotherapeutic drugs? Which is now what basically happens. Standard of care is usually often a chemotherapeutic drug like gemcitabine. One wants to add something to that, it'll be a kinase inhibitor. Which kinase inhibitor and what should the dosing schedule be? And then how can one assess the effectiveness of protein kinase inhibitors and other STIs? For kinase inhibitors, obviously, ideally, one would be looking at the phosphoprotein target, but that may be difficult, may require biopsy. Ideally, one would like, I think, you know, serum biomarkers, if at all possible, could be shed could be, you know, tumor, circulating tumor cells or proteins released from tumor cells. Could be the levels of surface proteins it induced via a pathway that's driven by the protein kinase. And something I'm going to touch on for a few minutes is how can one predict whether protein kinase inhibitor drugs will have unexpected effects, like unexpected feedback consequences. I'm sure Neil will touch on this, and I'll talk about it briefly. Can one develop phosphoproteomic signatures that can be used to define, measure the output of major signaling pathways, and can these be used to rapidly screen inhibitors for consequences that are likely to occur in vivo? And I think this will be important for developing the right combination of inhibitors when we testing combinations in culture and hoping that one can use this information in vivo. And something we talked about this morning, how could we, if stem cells really exist, how can we target those cells with this type of inhibitor and their signaling pathways? And something else, sort of be made a virtue of the fact that some of the initial inhibitors are not totally specific, like Gleevec or Sutent particularly. Can one actually, and they hit multiple kinases, and that may be why they work so well. And that's not such an issue if they're not toxic, but it would be nice perhaps to be able to design multi-kinase inhibitors that target combinations of kinases that are critical for a particular type of cancer. So is this at all relevant to pancreatic cancer? There have been some kinome-wide sequencing efforts on a small scale, I would say, so far, from my reading of the literature, and I think the results have been somewhat disappointing in the sense that there aren't any consistent mutations in pancreatic cancer. There are rare mutations in EGF receptor, BRAF, NTRK3 or TRK-C, and this guanylate cyclase-like kinase. There are reports of kinases, particularly receptor kinases, that are overexpressed in pancreatic cancer that might make targets. They may be, this could be due to translocations or some other form of amplification. These could be targets for drug therapy. But we do know, obviously, that there are signaling pathways that are activated in cancer, particularly downstream of the KRAS, which will activate the ERK MAP kinase pathway and the PI3 kinase pathways, which are potentially then targets, say, a MEK inhibitor and a PI3 kinase inhibitor. And there's also evidence that NF-kappa-B is activated in pancreatic cancer and STAT3, and these are also driven by kinases. And in terms of analyzing what pathways are activated, the Gigi group has, although not yet published, but reported at meetings, identified 3,000 distinct phosphoproteins or phosphopeptides in normal pancreas. And obviously, one would like to extend this now to pancreatic cancer and see exactly what differences there are. And I think this is probably a number, maybe an underestimate. I think spleen, he did spleen as well, and spleen had 20,000 different phosphorylation phosphopeptides, so this may well be an underestimate here. So in terms of what has been done with signal transduction inhibitors in pancreatic cancer, there are some reports that alotinib, then this is an EGF receptor inhibitor, shows clinical benefits in combination with gemcitabine, which is basically, as you've heard, the only therapeutic that has really any effect, and that's relatively modest. There are trials underway with the CCI-779. It's a rapamycin analog, PI3 kinase pathway inhibitor, gemcitabine. And trials underway with sorafenib, a RAF inhibitor, which would obviously lie downstream of activated RAS. But these are all, I think, all early days, and I think are not necessarily just totally rational. They are being done because these signal transduction inhibitors are available and approved. We heard this morning from Diane about the issue of DNA damage response and resistance to treatments that work through eliciting DNA damage. And Karnitz has shown that gemcitabine activates replication checkpoint signaling. It blocks DNA synthesis, leading to ATR and CHEK1 activation. And that group has recently shown that this Exelixis inhibitor, which is an inhibitor of CHEK1 and CHEK2, so it's a multi-kinase inhibitor, enhances gemcitabine killing of cell lines in culture in this PANC1 xenograft tumor, which may be no better than doing it in culture, I would agree. So I actually, if I get a chance, let's see how the time is going, I don't have so much time, I may just talk about some of our work we've been doing on CHEK1 and checkpoint regulation. So there are a number of major signaling pathways that are perturbed in cancers, not all activated in every cancer, but these are pathways that we know can be activated through oncogenic mutation or loss of tumor suppressor function. And several of these are activated in pancreatic cancer. We've already talked about the RAS pathway. The JAK-STAT pathway seems to be activated. NF-kappa-B, we've heard about potentially about the NOTCH pathway. And many of these involve protein kinases. So even if they're not mutated, potentially targeting protein kinases involved in these pathways would be one way to approach therapy. And the PI3 kinase pathway obviously is potentially very important, not only in pancreatic cancer, but in many types of cancer, because there are so many components of this pathway. This is my teaching slide here, which are mutated in cancer. For instance, the PI3 kinase catalytic subunit, PIK3CA, P110 alpha, is mutated in 25% of many and activated in many of different types of tumor. And this pathway impacts on mTOR, which is, as you know, a major driver of cell growth and indirectly, therefore, cell proliferation. So this is the PI3 kinase mTOR signaling pathway as we drew it. It's activated through a number of receptor tyrosine kinases at the cell surface, particularly the insulin IGF-1 receptors. Work through these adapter proteins, the IRS proteins, which bind to the activated autophosphorylated receptor through the PDB domain, become tyrosine phosphorylated themselves, and this then recruits a series of SH2-containing proteins that then activates different signaling pathways. And one of the most important here is the PI3 kinase pathway, which generates from PIP2... PIP3, PI345 phosphonosetides, which recruit pH domain containing proteins to the membrane, including AKT or PKB and PDK1. And this leads to the activation or partial activation of AKT, which actually requires a second phosphorylation event mediated by an mTOR complex. And once activated, AKT has many roles. It's important in cell survival. It's also very important in cell growth because it, through either phosphorylation of TSC2 or PRAS40, activates this mTORC1 complex that contains RAPTOR. This is the target. This complex mTORC1 is the target for rapamycin, which inhibits its activity. This pathway is also regulated by nutrient input somehow, yet not very well defined, to mTORC1, and also by energy status of the cell, which is mediated through AMP, which activates this kinase AMPK that in turn activates TSC2 through phosphorylation. And this works through the REB, RHEB, REB small G protein that is an activator of this mTORC1 complex. So this pathway is sort of normally drawn as a fairly linear pathway coming through a receptor tyrosine kinase, through PI3 kinase, AKT, TSC, to mTORC1. And mTORC1 can drive cell growth through enhancing protein synthesis, for instance, through phosphorylating, activating S6 kinase, or phosphorylating 4EBP1, releasing 4EIF4G, which is an initiation factor. But it turns out that on looking at this more closely, and this is our work and the work of several other groups, this pathway is regulated in a complex fashion by feedback and crosstalk. And this emerged actually largely in this case through using genetic knockout models and use of rapamycin as an mTORC inhibitor. And what's emerged is that there is a feedback loop on insulin IGF-1 signaling from activated mTOR and actually the downstream S6 kinase, which works through IRS1 and 2, and work from our group in collaboration with Inder Verma's group has shown there's a crosstalk to NF-kappa-B from mTOR. And there are a couple of other feedback loops that I'll just touch on very briefly. So this is the feedback loop from S6 kinase. This was work carried out by Jamil Shah in my lab. Also, George Thomas's lab and Richard Lamb's lab have very similar data published about the same time, which showed that in cells with hyperactive mTOR, largely in this case through loss of function mutations in the TSC tumor suppressor protein modeled in mice by knockout, where there's hyperactive mTOR, insulin receptor signaling is strongly downregulated. And these cells, TSC-deficient cells, are highly insulin-resistant. And what we and the other two groups worked out is that this is through S6 kinase, which feeds back on IRS1 and IRS2, the adapter proteins, at several levels. S6 kinase directly phosphorylates IRS1 and IRS2 and uncouples it from the receptor. But IRS1 and IRS2 are also degraded in response to this feedback in a ubiquitin proteasome-dependent manner, and this depends on phosphorylation of IRS1 by S6 and other kinases. There's also a feedback at the level of RNA, and the levels of RNA for IRS1 and IRS2 are also reduced. So as a result, then, these cells are relatively unresponsive to both to insulin and IGF-1, and also probably to other growth factors like PDGF as well. So actually, this renders these cells susceptible to DNA damage-induced apoptosis through defects in AKT, which is a major survival signaling kinase, as well as potentially through NF-kappa-B activation. And this is the work that Saurabh Ghosh and Vinay Tirogkar carried out, showing that TSC2 null cells show a very robust reduction in activation of NF-kappa-B in response to either DNA damage induced by doxorubicin or MMS, or TNF-alpha. The mechanism is still not entirely clear. We know that the DNA damage-induced activation of NF-kappa-B requires ERK-MAP kinases, and the TNF activation requires AKT. And exactly how hyperactive mTOR abrogates these two activation pathways, we do not know. But what it means is that these cells are, in fact, deficient in NF-kappa-B survival activation. So we can now add a lot to this signaling pathway. There's a feedback loop from S6 kinase that damps down upstream signaling and therefore damps down AKT activation. There's this crosstalk to the NF-kappa-B activation pathway. Brendan Manning has defined another feedback or crosstalk to the Wnt signaling pathway through inhibition of GSK3. And although I won't have time to tell you, it looks like there is another feedback going from AKT to mTORC2. So mTORC2 is the second mTOR complex. It contains RICTOR instead of RAPTOR. And this is responsible for phosphorylating the other activation site in AKT, in addition to the site that's phosphorylated by PDK1. And if you inhibit AKT, either through depletion or through a small molecule inhibitor, this upregulates AKT phosphorylation at the serine 473 site, implying there's some sort of negative feedback through AKT that damps down mTORC2 signaling. So I've already run on for about 35 minutes. I can stop here or I can tell you one brief story on the Check 1 work. What would the organizers like me to do? Okay, I'll try and do this quickly then. Oh, I guess before I move to that then, let me just say that our understanding of any of these feedbacks and crosstalks does have potential implications for therapy, and Neil may well talk about this, because if one treats a cell, as many cancer cells have hyperactive mTOR, if you treat that cell with rapamycin to block mTOR signaling, this has the effect of upregulating IGF-1 receptor signaling and AKT activation. And so the suggestion is, and I know this is being tried, that one should use rapamycin in combination with an inhibitor of IGF-1 receptor or PI3 kinase or AKT to block this enhanced survival signaling. And in terms of NF-kappa-B crosstalk, what the results suggest is that rapamycin could be used effectively in combination with either an IKK inhibitor to block NF-kappa-B activation, which is upregulated, or maybe some other NF-kappa-B inhibitor. So as I've said, gemcitabine, which is really only effective therapy for pancreatic cancer, acts by blocking DNA synthesis, and this triggers checkpoint signaling, particularly replication checkpoint signaling, by blocking DNA synthesis. And there is some evidence that an inhibitor of CHK1 could be effective in pancreatic cancer. Now, what the work of Yue Zhang and Bob Abraham showed at the Burnham Institute was that loss of CHK1 activity in tumor cells, others have shown this as well, leads to an irreversible S-phase arrest and cell death. And when if one, in fact, treats many tumor cells with camptothecin, which is a topoisomerase inhibitor, this leads to the loss of CHK1 protein. And that is potentially a mechanism through which camptothecin actually can induce tumor regression. And what they found was that there are some tumor cells, though, which do not exhibit this camptothecin-induced degradation of CHK1. And this may be one mechanism of chemo resistance in those cases. So the replication checkpoint, then, this is the so-called S-phase checkpoint, is activated by replicative stress, which generally means damaged DNA during S-phase or else stalled replication forks. And this activates a complex of proteins of which the major functional component is the ATR protein kinase, which, in combination with an adapter called Claspin, leads to the activation of CHK1, through phosphorylation of at least two sites. Serine 345 is probably most important. And then activated CHEK1 has a series of target proteins which result in S-phase arrest or G2M arrest, depending on timing, repair, and potentially cell death. This same pathway can also be activated through double-strand breaks induced by irradiation. Through ATM, a related protein kinase that can activate ATR. And this pathway, this checkpoint, is terminated in a variety of ways and is important, obviously, for the cell to re-enter the cell cycle after the damage is resolved, if it can be. And amongst the mechanisms are protein phosphatases that act at various levels. But in addition, what Yue Zhang showed was that this can potentially be resolved through CHEK1 degradation, or as other groups have shown, through claspin degradation, which then results in the inactivation of CHEK1 and the release from the checkpoint. So what Yue Zhang showed was then that in some cancer cell lines, that treatment with camptothecin causes initially activation of CHEK1 through ATR-mediated phosphorylation, but then this was subsequently followed by downregulation of CHEK1 protein, and I think that's shown here. So if you treat A549 lung cancer cells with 500 nanomolar camptothecin, you can see that CHEK1 levels slowly decline over the next few hours. And what happens then is that these cells then re-enter the cell cycle without repairing the damage or completing S phase, and they enter mitosis prematurely and undergo apoptosis. So what they showed was that this results in ATR activation, and that this in turn causes ubiquitin-dependent degradation of CHEK1, requiring phosphorylation of this activating serine 345 site. And they went further and tried to identify the ubiquitin ligase that is responsible for this, and they showed that an SCF, well, I'll show you what this is in a second, skip colon FBOX protein complex, E3 ligase, is apparently responsible for CHEK1 ubiquitination and ultimately degradation. So colon-based complexes are multi-subunit ubiquitin ligases, in which there's a colon subunit associated with a ring finger protein that acts as the E2 recruiting subunit. There is an adapter subunit of variable nature, and then an FBOX protein in the case of the SCF complexes or some other substrate specificity subunit. And what their efforts had shown was that CUL1, which is part of the SCF complex, and these often recognize their substrates in a phosphorylation-dependent manner, use an FBOX protein to recognize the phosphorylated substrate. So their model then was that replication stress activated ATR, phosphorylated CHEK1. This led to its recognition by an SCF complex containing an unknown FBOX, and this resulted in degradation and checkpoint termination. And so UA has now in my group has screened using an siRNA library targeting all 68 human FBOX genes for stabilization of CHEK1 in A549 lung cancer cells. And he has identified through this two FBOX proteins whose depletion results in stabilization. FBX6 has an FBOX that associates it with SCIP1 and this so-called FBOX-associated domain. And beta-TRCP1, which is a WD40 repeat protein, has these seven WD 40 repeats and an F-box. And this just shows you some of the data here. So if you look... 2 minutes, okay. So they are stabilized. Check one is stabilized by comparison with control cells, particularly when cells are treated with camptothecin. And he was able to show that both of these FBOX proteins bind to and interact with CHEK1 by doing pull-down experiments, and that overexpression of either of these two FBOX proteins enhances ubiquitination in vivo and in vitro. And we were able to map a degron in a C-terminal regulatory region of CHEK1. This is the kinase domain. This regulates the function of CHEK1. We've been able to map a region required for this degradation into this region here. So we call this a degron-like region. It's distinct from the C-terminal region here, which others have shown is required for inhibition of kinase activity. So the model is that phosphorylation of these SQ residues here by ATR opens up the conformation, releasing this autoinhibition, but at the same time exposing a degron-like region that is now responsible for ubiquitination of CHEK1. So I will skip this and simply just leave you then with our current model, and that is that CHEK1 in a cell without any replication stress has low kinase activity and is a poor substrate for ubiquitination by these two SCF complexes. Following DNA damage, replication stress has a conformational change resulting from phosphorylation of serine 345 and 317. This now relieves this autoinhibition. This has high kinase activity, but it also becomes a good substrate for SCF ubiquitination and ultimately gets degraded. And what we're trying to do now is to determine why some cancer cells are resistant to this degradative mechanism. Is there a defect in some aspect of the E3 ligases? And is this important for chemo resistance in cancers in patients? And I think the bottom line will be that specific CHEK1 inhibitors may well be useful in combination with drugs that activate replication stress, which would override particularly any resistance to replication stress-induced degradation. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll leave this slide up, which is always a favorite of mine in terms of how long it takes to develop a cancer therapy. The development of Gleevec took 150 years.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. So I think it would be natural to take any questions on my talk can be done during the discussion after Neil, because he's going to carry on discussing the use of signal transduction inhibitors in cancer therapy.
I'm Neil Rosen. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I rent space at Memorial Sloan Kettering. Mechanism-based cancer therapy is the title of this. Could we do worse or can we do better? I know less about pancreatic cancer than Inder does. What I work on is mechanism-based therapies, or hopefully work on mechanism-based therapies. I think we do badly in pancreatic cancer for three related but not identical reasons. We don't detect the tumor early enough. If we do detect the tumor early, our treatment is poor. 20% cure rates is not good, even for small resectable lesions. But I'm not going to talk about either of those things, which would be great advances if we could do them better. I'm going to talk about the treatment of metastatic or locally advanced non-resectable disease, and I can end the talk now and have time for questions, as I don't think we have any relevant ways of doing that. So I will talk about when I don't have anything relevant to say, I talk about microarrays or I talk about other stuff that I do in the lab. I will talk about the general, I will start with the general thesis upon which many of our work, I would venture to say David's and other people's work here, Channing's, is based. And that is that the development of an understanding of signaling, of the pathways that regulate growth and apoptosis and differentiation and even stem cells will lead to the identification of nodes that are commonly oncogenically activated. And I would say parenthetically that all of the 130 kinases that have been found to be mutated in cancer, most of them are extremely uncommon mutations. But if we understand the pathophysiology of the tumor, which is arguably based on the initiating mutations and the ensembles of mutations associated with those events, we will develop effective therapies. And for those of you who are not in the field, I would just point out that for old guys like me, this is just a slide I made up in about 1997 on EGFR signaling. The point is no human oncogenes had been identified till 1982. There were no elements of signaling pathways known except for PKA, insulin receptor, and EGFR at that time. We didn't even know how to mispronounce apoptosis 25 years ago, nor did we know any elements of the cycle apparatus. So the awesome power of genetics and other things has led to an incredible advance in knowledge, identification of the oncogenes, and if not, as certainly far from an understanding of cancer in detail or these pathways in detail, we now have a general feeling about what the molecular basis for the ontogeny of cancer is, which is mutations in these pathways. So the hypothesis is that inhibitors of these pathways or inhibitors of the pathways that are responsible for driving the tumor will be more effective than agents developed before developed empirically or I don't like the word cytotoxic since I like things that kill cancer cells. Let's say empirically developed poisons, it's going to be more effective. And unfortunately, the idea came that they would be less toxic because we know that RAS and PI3 kinase have no normal functions, inhibitors of these pathways has been less toxic, which during the discussion, I'll tell you, this idea is one thing that really impedes the development of effective anti-cancer therapies since we no longer tolerate toxicity. The proofs of principle that this hypothesis will work are not first Gleevec, but first flutamide and tamoxifen, which, after all, inhibit transcription factors that are dependent upon which lineage-dependent proliferation of breast and prostate are required, and that works. A whole variety of drugs, which you know about, and I won't waste time talking about it, work in this way. So to go back to the stem cell hypothesis, what happens if this actually works? If you have a drug that actually hits a pathway that is actually important for the tumor. So I don't know. I know less about leukemias than I know about pancreas cancer, which is unbelievable. So I got these slides from David Sheinberg. Acute promyelocytic leukemia, which has a 15-17 translocation of retinoic acid receptor to the APL gene. Is a terrible leukemia. Patients get very sick with DIC and other manifestations. They die very quickly. Very aggressive chemotherapy used to cure about 35% of patients. As soon as retinoids went into practice here, you began getting complete responses just by taking this vitamin every day. Patients eventually relapsed, but adding a little low-dose chemotherapy and then a couple of other drugs at low, not particularly toxic doses, at Sloan Kettering at least, and I'm sure at everybody else's institution here, the last 38 patients we've had with this disease, 37 are in sustained complete remissions without off drugs. So you can cure this disease. Now, just I'll yell at Mace because he's my friend. This is what happens when you in a solid tumor when you give an effective drug. This is a patient treated by Mark Chris at Sloan Kettering with an EGF receptor inhibitor. Patient had EGFR mutation. We did not know that at the time. This is the patient's bronchoalveolar carcinoma. This is what happened 5 days after starting on gefitinib. Now, When this patient recurred 11 months later, if you want to say this is because of a stem cell that did not respond, that is fine with me. You did not have to biopsy this patient to see dying tumor cells, to see the fact that the tumor went away. Now, the reason it came back, stem cells, adaptation of the signaling pathway, selection of resistant subpopulations of tumors with T790 mutations or other genetics that render them insusceptible to the drug, we can start talking about that. I would suggest, and they invited me to be provocative. I'm usually not like this, but Daphne made me do this. I would submit to you, you don't see this in pancreas cancer very often, and that right now, until we develop drugs that do something like this, then we can talk prima facie about the possibility that stem cells are responsible for our inability to cure this patient. The other thing we can talk about, I steal everything I say, so this I steal from David. David Tuveson once used the expression a genetic therapeutic index. So if you take these patients with lung cancer with EGFR mutation, if you take the ones with EGFR mutation and treat them as a separate population, which the companies assiduously avoid, they say they don't want to reduce their market 90%, 75% of those patients have a real partial response by RECIST criteria, which means a very significant regression of tumor. If you take patients with a KRAS mutation, this is data of William Power and Mark Chris at Sloan Kettering, there is a 0% probability of response. And I think I'm right, David, that this is what you'd consider a genetic therapeutic index. So by doing this and by talking about the stuff Tony was just talking about, you can divide non-small cell lung cancer now into a variety of mutations, most of which look epistatic, that dominantly perhaps drive the tumor, some that are very rare, HER2 or rare, BRAF, some that are sort of common like EGFR or CDK4 or KRAS. You can divide the tumor into different pathophysiologies based by which dominant mutations are driving the tumor and try to develop therapies based on this. And I believe what progress in the future is going to depend, and we are now doing this, on sequencing patients for the relevant mutations. This can be done. Just because it hasn't been done so far, it can be done rather cheaply over the next several years, and dividing patients by pathways, Jeff talked about this morning, rather than just by lineage. What are the pitfalls of the approach? All of these pathways have key physiologic functions. Understanding of their role in normal and tumor physiology is limited, which is a euphemism for unknown. Therefore, the therapeutic index is key and not deducible a priori. Current animal models are inadequate as therapeutic models to the extent of defining therapeutic index. Inadequate can be taken as meaning not perfect. I think David's comment before is correct. The animal models are getting much better, but there are issues we could talk about in the discussion. So now I'll get to the negative part of the talk, if you thought that was negative. So this is a summary of the average meeting I go to on this topic. There are lots of good targets for which we have inhibitors. All of these targets have key normal functions. None of the inhibitors are toxic, no matter how many targets they hit. Just hit hundreds of kinases and you'll cure cancer, or if not that, at least you'll make money. All of the drugs have great preclinical anti-tumor activity, and we still haven't cured cancer yet. Okay, so the questions are A, why, and B, I want to make a plea from this as well. Daphne told me not to talk about rapamycin, so I can't respond to what Tony said. But the fact is, this is to the scientists here. In vitro systems, transgenic mice are all great systems, so are patients. Do not ignore the results of clinical trials, okay, if they are well done. There's a lot of great preclinical data that mTOR is the key target of AKT, and that that P10 negative and other tumors are extremely responsible to mTOR, to TORC1 inhibition. There's a lot of great clinical data that this is nonsense, Okay. Now, one can try to explain away the clinical data, but one shouldn't ignore that. Whether or not that's relevant to pancreas cancer, in which Tarceva has given an extraordinary 12-day increase in median survival, and as to the question of whether EGFR really plays any role at all in maintaining advanced disease, I leave to discussion here, but it at least has to be discussed. Okay, so this is what happens with the more average targeted therapy. We all know that angiogenesis is absolutely key to the maintenance of large tumors. So this is what you get when you add Avastin to chemotherapy for lung cancer. I've often suggested that the doctors, before talking about this wonder drug, show this Kaplan-Meier plot to patients who are getting this wonder drug. The difference between these two curves is something I would be proud to have as duplicates in my lab. And if you want to know what this difference, it means several billion dollars a year in revenue. That's what it means. Okay, this is not a dependency. It is an experiment, and it's not an experiment that says the growth of large tumors is absolutely dependent on angiogenesis. Okay, why has success been limited? So I have to be tolerant of myself and others and say we're still at the beginning. We haven't been doing this very long. The first therapy that was developed as targeted therapy hasn't been in that started about 15 years ago. But there are other questions we have to look at ourselves in the mirror about. Are we picking the right targets? Do we understand the biology of the target? Do we use that understanding? What is a rational combination of inhibitors? Two drugs made by the same company is not a rational combination of inhibitors, but the facts are that is what is done. Are we inhibiting the target in patients in the way that we want to? And I hope Dave Tuveson is going to be talking about this a little bit. Things like pharmacology, which I know are boring, like does the drug get into the tumor? Does it hit the target? And when it hits the target, how much are we hitting the target? Are we hitting it adequately? Are generally very difficult to do and not done. We've got to learn how to do that more. And what constitutes exciting preclinical data? If 58 xenografts do not respond to EGF receptor inhibition, showing that A431 and DIFI do, does not constitute a failure of xenografts. It constitutes a failure of imagination. You've got to, before you take stuff into clinic, ask yourself what the actual evidence to target is important. So how should we choose targets? Mutated at high frequency in cancer, I think, is indisputably the best way to choose a target right now. I know it doesn't get at the tumor as an organ. It doesn't get at stromal tumor interactions. It gets only at autonomous tumor cell function. But empirically, this is what has had the most probability of working. And I don't think we understand yet what we're going to understand over the next years about how to rationally hit those stromal tumor cell interactions. Second, regulator of a key cancer phenotype. Estrogen receptor and usually androgen receptor are not mutated in those diseases, yet inhibiting those lineage-dependent required growth factors are powerful and not particularly toxic therapeutic agents, which is why I asked this morning, and I still think it's a relevant question, if you take the cell of origin or take the ductal cell normally, are there lineage-dependent growth factors upon which the proliferation of those cells depends, inhibition of which may not be particularly toxic, that can be used to hit early stage premalignant lesions as a preventive? Overexpressed in cancer is a contradiction in so many terms, I don't know where to start. This became a target when microarrays became available. The receptor is rarely overexpressed since we don't know the stem cells. You never know over compared to what. And there is no reason to think prima facie that something that's overexpressed actually has a causal relationship to the disease. Similarly, with associated with poor prognosis. Show me a lesion that is associated with good prognosis pancreatic cancer. If it's a mutation, I still think it might drive those cancers. And finally, although most of us in this room don't do this, if you find some, the idea of finding something in the soil of an Amazonian rainforest, if we found something like that today that killed 40% of pancreas tumors in transgenic models, we would throw it out because it's boring. So empirical anti-tumor activity is a good thing if you're dealing with patients who have nothing else. Okay, targets in pancreatic cancer. I should say that I know little about this. Channing Durr wrote two great reviews this year, one in Oncogene, and I forget where the other one was, Channing, but these are terrific and detailed, thoughtful summaries of the data as it is. But as I just said, I believe mutated targets are the best target. So KRAS, so the best targets are those that are mutated, those in which you've shown the biology is recapitulated in some model. Those that you've shown are druggable, which is the problem for KRAS, and those that you've shown, if you can drug the target, which sounds like a verb from Houston, to drug the target, if the mutation is required for maintenance of the advanced disease rather than perhaps just development of the tumor. So KRAS mutation, I'm going to talk about a fair amount. SMAD4 loss occurs in approximately 50% of patients. This might be deemed to just inactivate TGF-beta signaling, but it also might be deemed to activate the non-growth inhibitory aspects of TGF-beta, making TGF-beta inhibitors potentially useful here, or inhibitors of some of the downstream activating limbs of the TGF-beta pathway. There are TGF-beta receptor inhibitors that are now under development. These may be useful. P16 loss. I don't know if humans this carries the same significance as carrying P16 and P19. There are CDK4 inhibitors that were developed by Pfizer. I don't know where they have gone or been. They are very selective drugs. And finally, cadherin mutations occur in a fair percentage of patients, but I don't know of a good way, others may know here and can discuss later, a good way of drugging the downstream pathways activated by cadherin inactivating mutations. Inhibitors of beta-catenin signaling might be useful there. Then we get pathway activation or overexpression. So EGFR is one that's been around for a long time. I would say right now this issue is at least debatable as to whether EGFR overexpression is important. Tarceva, to my mind, the increase in survival with Tarceva is so minuscule that we would have done a disservice by having that approved and paid for. So there is no evidence from Tarceva that there is any dependency on EGFR of the kind you see in mutant EGFR lung cancer or even in variant EGFR expressing glioblastoma. Now, this is not necessarily the last word. It is possible, Channing was laughing at me last night when I was telling him this, but it is possible that inhibiting EGFR kinase creates a kinase-dead EGFR that can still signal by transphosphorylation. And it is a real fact that, unexplained but interesting, that Erbitux works, the antibody to EGFR works in colon cancer, and the small molecule kinase inhibitors do not. So we have to understand more about the biochemistry of this, but we should not enshrine EGFR as a clear factor. Hedgehog signaling, others can talk about this. Brian can talk about it much better than I can. I think there's a lot of data from Phil Beachy. I think that some of that is under some dispute. There is a drug for this pathway, cyclopamine. It certainly works in sheep. Whether or not Genentech will be able to develop non-cyclopamine drugs that they can make a profit on, and whether cyclopamine actually can be used in people, which to me, again, is a point clouded in mystery, I don't know. And I'm still not sure hedgehog is really important for maintenance of the tumor. Steve and others know much more about Notch, and it was talked about this morning. AKT signaling is interesting, and I will get into that later. The mechanism of AKT activation in pancreatic cancer is not so clear to me. It may be due to KRAS mutation, but despite Julian Downward's recent paper, it is not clear to me how robustly KRAS mutation actually activates AKT in real tumors. But PAKT is demonstrable in pancreatic tumors, and this may be important. And I'll leave the NF-kappa. I don't have time to talk about VAV, and I presume NF-kappa B will be talked about by Mike. So The last thing I'll say before I launch into RAS is that we tend not to understand the biologic consequences of target inhibition in real tumors, and that's been the failure of genetics. So it is very hard for me to ascertain from the data what KRAS is actually doing in pancreatic cancer. What aspect of transformation is mediated by KRAS, or for that matter, any of the other mutations in other tumor lineages? And first of all, I think it's sad that I believe that, because we've been studying these genes for a very long time. And secondly, this is a block to our ability to do things usefully clinically. We have to know what to expect, the biology we expect to evoke when we inhibit the target in order to design the appropriate clinical trials. I think the reason for this is the shortcomings of many of our model systems. And I think the reason for that, and this gets into Tony's talk, is the signaling system is not a series of linear non-interacting pathways. It's a non-linear, mutually interacting, non-intelligently designed network. And when you perturb this network with the loss of expression or mutational activation or siRNA, you cause feedback and compensation throughout the network. And the point is, the feedback and compensation that creates a new network is a particular function of which mutations are there, how high, what their level of expression is, and in which order they occurred. Because these are not order-independent phenomena. So if you don't mimic them exactly in your tumor model, you will not get the right network and you will not get the right experimental answer when you inhibit it. I may be wrong about this, but I doubt that the EGFR mice, nobody tell Harold I said this, I doubt that the mutant EGFR mice in lung are an exact mirror of what happens in human tumors, and certainly the kinds of dependency you get on the mutated oncogene in those mice is quite amazing, and likely to be much more dependent than actual human tumors. So, in addition to genetics, we think that using small molecule inhibitors for pathway dissection adds something to our genetic analyses. And this I call chemical biology, because if I call it pharmacology, nobody will invite me to meetings. So the good thing about small molecule inhibitors is they allow inhibition of activity of the target rather than expression of the target. There's no reason, if you believe in networks, to believe that inhibiting expression gives you the same results as inhibiting activity. And Kevan Shulhat wrote a good review of this in Cell a couple of months ago. What you can see with small molecules that is very difficult to see with genetic manipulation is the rapid kinetics and rapid changes in feedback of adaptation in the network. siRNA is not better and it's not worse. It's just different. With siRNA, you are modeling the effects on the network and on the output of slow loss of expression of the protein. With small molecules, you're measuring rapid loss of activity. There are multiple examples now in my lab and other labs of siRNA giving you different answers. It models therapeutic intervention, small molecules. Until siRNA works therapeutically or antisense, this is the way we're going to make drugs. And it allows the interrogation of human models, cell lines, xenografts, and even patients. But the problem here, as I'm sure all of you will be quick to leap up and say, is the lack of specificity of these drugs. So when you do this, you have to be very, very careful to have drugs that are as selective as possible. Natural products like rapamycin or allosteric inhibitors like the one I'm going to show you that, as far as you can see, inhibit very, very few targets, and you always have to be very vigilant in trying to understand what other targets might be there. So, strategies for inhibiting mutated KRAS. Well, I'm not going to go through this. I presume, I guess I thought we would talk about it a lot, but everybody here knows KRAS, a variety of upstream signals signal through RAS. RAS is mutated in lots of tumors, including somewhere between 60 and 90% of pancreatic tumors. That results in activation of multiple targets, including the members of the RAF family, PI3K, RAL-GDS, the TIAMs, but phospholipase E, and causes transformation. So what are the strategies for inhibiting mutated RAS? This is where we have failed, okay? And that, I think, is still, until we identify better strategies and better understanding of the tumor, if we're going to talk, I guess what I'm going to talk about now is really prospects for what we can do for patients in the next 2 to 3 years while we are getting a better understanding of the tumor biology. I'd say right now, if you had to pick a therapeutic target for this disease, if you had to pick one, unfortunately, it would still be KRAS. Unfortunately, because we've been so lousy at it so far. Okay, so what have we tried to do? We've tried to inhibit RAS activity. There's a variety of ways. I'm not going to go through this very quickly. You can read Channing's articles, which are much better than I can talk about. You can inhibit the activity of mutated RAS by creating chaperones that restore the GTPase activity, small molecules. Daphne is working on an idea with SOS, which is perhaps will be useful in the future. You could also inhibit the interaction of RAS with its effectors. So far, these ideas are at best not ready for prime time, and at worst, they've mostly not yielded things of potential therapeutic use. Secondly, you could inhibit RAS expression if only antisense worked, if only siRNA would work. Right now, not ready, not useful now, but I would never say not in 5 years, especially with development of siRNA targeting technologies. Third, modulators of subcellular localization. Adrian, I tried to find a fancy way of not saying farnesyl transferase inhibitors. So the only reason this is up here, and it's probably not important for this group, it is amazing how many people still think inhibiting RAS doesn't work because FTIs didn't work. You can still see this at meetings now, 12 years later. So as you know, RAS is farnesylated. HK and NRAS are prenylated. They get into the membrane. There's then a proteolytic cleavage of the C-terminal Cax box, methylation of the cysteine, and all those steps are required for proper membrane localization. So it was a great idea to inhibit this first step, farnesylation. And that would inhibit RAS, and it does, but it just inhibits HRAS. We've known for years through the work of Adrian and others that KRAS is geraniol geranylated, so this doesn't work. There are other potential methods for manipulating this. You could inhibit geraniol transferase, but that might not have a therapeutic index because so many G proteins are affected by that. You could inhibit the protease or the methylation. Pat Casey is working on this. But right now, I'd say those strategies are very primitive and not very promising. Adrian and Mark Phillips also just published a paper showing a very interesting PKC targeting of RAS to the mitochondrial membrane where it induces apoptosis. I think that is early work that requires more evidence that will work in a physiologic system, but at least it is a possibility. So the major way we have of inhibiting RAS today is by inhibiting RAS effectors. So there are multiple RAS effectors. The most well characterized, the most traditionally and oldest, are the RAF proteins, which activate a cascade. RAS activates a cascade of serine kinases in the MAPK family to give you, in the case of RAS, it activates the three members of the RAF family, then two MEK kinases, which activate two P-ERKs, and that exerts lots of the biologic effects of RAS. In addition to that, there are multiple other effectors, of which PI3 kinase and RAL-GDS are worthwhile mentioning. Firstly, because as Tony showed, activation of PI3 kinase occurs in probably the majority of human tumors, and many of the mutations Tony talked about are in the PI3K pathway. RAL-GDS, because Chris Counter and others have shown that RAL-GDS activation is key to RAS transformation in a variety of systems, and I should mention Channing and Adrian in that work too. Having said all that, we don't have PI3K/AKT inhibitors in clinic or only in very early clinical trials. We have no way to inhibit RAL-GDS. There are inhibitors of receptors which may not be useful in RAS disease. So right now we're looking at the development of lots and lots of compounds that inhibit either RAF kinase or MEK kinase. And these are in clinic, and some of them are in moderately, not late clinical trial, but in the midst of early clinical trial. I never correct Dr. Hunter, but sorafenib is the non-RAF inhibitor, RAF inhibitor. It inhibits hundreds of kinases. It is a very poor inhibitor of RAF in vivo. So we can't get into the same problem we got into with farnesyl transferases. The lack of activity of sorafenib in pancreas cancer will tell you nothing about what RAF-MAPK is doing in pancreas cancer. So I had 45. What happened to the 45?
I won't argue with
you. Don't argue with me.
I don't want trouble.
If you don't want trouble, don't argue with me. So I'm actually a nice guy. Just ask anybody. All right, so what role does this play in malignancy? What role does RAF-MAPK play in a malignancy? Except it's mutated all over the place. What's it doing? Well, the major ways of activating RAS-RAF-MAPK, there are multiple mechanisms in human cancer, including receptor tyrosine kinase activation. And I'm not going to mention all of them. I'm just going to mention KRAS activation, which is relevant here, BRAF mutation, and receptor kinase activation. So as was mentioned by multiple talks, including this morning, there's a lot we don't know. What's the biologic function? Is the functional output dependent on the mechanism of activation? That is mutant K different than BRAF or different than activated RTK? What answers Murray's question? Why is it so predominant in pancreas? Why is activation of the pathway also predominant in melanoma? But there it's NRAS or BRAF, but not KRAS. And why in breast and prostate and small cell and esophagus is the pathway rarely, if ever, mutationally activated? Why are certain elements of the pathways commonly mutated in cancers and some rarely, if ever, mutated, but sometimes in the germline? And what accounts for the co-selection of mutations in other signaling pathways? So I would submit to you, we don't understand the pathway and we're not going to be able to exploit this clinically until we understand or have some handle on these questions. So just because of what I said before, we've used a small molecule inhibitor and others have used a small molecule inhibitor of MEK to address the questions of what MAP kinase is doing in these tumors. And I'll show this real fast like a movie because some of this is published and some of you knew this data. What is nice about the MEK inhibitor, it's an allosteric inhibitor that binds in a ternary complex, non-competitive inhibitor, binds to an allosteric site, and it's really, really selective. I cannot tell you it's absolutely selective, but the only other kinase we've seen that inhibits is MEK kinase, kinase 5, which at about 100-fold higher concentrations. It's also good that it's potent and it can be used in vivo, even in people. And the take-home paper we published a couple of years ago, the take-home lesson is this. Not very surprisingly, and this is all cell lines on plastic, BRAF mutant tumors are incredibly sensitive. Surprisingly, at least to me, receptor tyrosine kinase tumors like mutant EGFR or HER2 tumors are insensitive in soft agar, on plastic, and in xenografts, and probably in patients. So receptor tyrosine kinase activated tumors, at least HER2, EGFR, are not obviously dependent on MAPK in a tumor autonomous fashion anyway. And RAS tumors, and here is the boring deflating punchline, are sometimes sensitive and sometimes not. I will skip that. I will tell you that what we think we know about RAS or MAPK is that it's required for cyclin D expression, it's required for the CDK4 cyclin D complex assembly and other things in G1, and it's exquisitely required for the G1S transition. And this turns out to be true in the BRAF tumors. It is not true at all in the RTK tumors, in which these processes are completely independent of MAPK activation. And this is true in xenografts as well. I know David doesn't like these, but what the hell, I'm a lazy guy. So the BRAF tumors are